Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right. Hey, Nicole, thank you so much for joining me on the Preacher Boys podcast. Can you please share a little bit about yourself and introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah. So my name is Nicole. And let's see, share a little bit about myself. I grew up in the IFB for 30 years or so. Got out of it. And I am now married to a wonderful man. And I have two children. And I work from home.
What was your introduction to the IFB? Were you born into it? Was it something that you got into at a very early age? Do you even remember your first time, or was it just kind of something that was always a part of your life?
It was essentially something that was always a part of my life. I believe, according to my mom, she said I was about 2 years old when we started going to Mountain Avenue. So that's really all I've ever known.
Right. And this interview is actually really unique, and I can't believe I didn't say it in the beginning, but we actually went to the same church and school. So this is definitely an interesting one, because this one's right in my backyard as far as interviews go. So, what's your earliest memory? Do you remember your initial experiences being pretty positive? Because I know for a lot of people, you know, some people say there was, you know, never a good time or there was never good experiences. But for other people, you know, I know for me, there's a lot of good experiences intertwined with, you know, maybe the more negative. So can you share a little bit about your early memories, whether it was positive, negative, just a little bit of context there?
It was actually very, very positive. I don't know if I know you remember Pastor Stalnecker.
Right. Yeah.
Honestly, he was a great pastor. All of the teachers that were there, the Sunday school teachers that were there at that time, were not IFB related in how they treated other people, if that makes sense.
Right.
He was very much so, hey, here's what I believe. You need to make your own decision.
Right.
And even my school teachers at that time were the same way.
Right.
So I would say yes, like it was positive. And I would absolutely, if he were back there and everybody that was there at that time, I would totally go back.
So he was there till I was in, I want to say third grade. So I have very limited memories of him, but they were positive. But it's one of those things where like I don't have a, I don't know if it was positive just because I was young and like I was positive toward everybody or so. Yeah. From what I remember, super positive. And I just remember, you know, I don't have any negative memories associated, which I guess, you know, talking to people on this show, not having early negative memories associated with the pastor is a a good thing to be thankful for. So we talked a little bit right before we recorded, and you said that, you know, kind of your first time you noticed something was a little bit off within the movement was in your high school years. Can you talk a little bit about that and what it was that kind of, was it just a weird sense of things? Was it a specific instance that kind of started waking up to some things? What was that first negative experience?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So the first part that brought something up that was negative or like started opening up my eyes was Mr. Dorchis when I went into youth group.
Okay.
Now, I think I have, and here's a little bit of background. I think I have a little bit of a unique situation because number one, I wasn't a pastor's kid. I wasn't, you know, any of that. My mom was a secretary, but you know, being a secretary, she was a part of everything for the school, for the church. And I helped her a lot.
Right.
And so I saw discrepancies that I would say most people wouldn't have seen that early on per se, because it really wasn't a bad school to go to and it wasn't a bad church to go to. But what I was realizing, because my mom is saying one thing, and then you have Mr. Dorchis, who is completely telling me something different. That was, you know, so I was kind of, I didn't really know what was true and what was right.
Right.
And so that's what kind of started opening.
And when you say something different, are you saying like different theology, different, you know, ideas about the church or the school, different rules and standards? Like what was different in the teaching? Like what was the kind of discrepancy?
That's a great question. So what was different? Pastor Stalnecker was all about, you read the Bible, you come up with your own convictions, your own standards based off of that between you and God. He goes, here's what I believe, but I'm not forcing you to do the same thing. And then Mr. Dorchis, which, okay, it sounds so silly, it really does, but like, if I didn't have skirts that were below my knee, I was sinning and I was wrong.
Right.
And, you know, I was seducing. I was in freaking high school, but I was seducing men.
Right.
You know, music. My mom loves the oldies and we used to listen to 50s and 60s music.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as he found out that I was listening to that stuff, I was wrong.
Right.
You know, and it just kind of, it got further more legalistic as I got older.
How did that relationship develop? Was it something where, you know, that just remained a one-on-one kind of pressuring? Is it something where, you know, sometimes when there's disagreements or things like that, like that gets used as leverage and they try to affect other areas of your life? Was it something where other people started slowly getting involved and piling onto you for doing things differently than maybe the majority would or than he would?
That's a loaded question.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. Just give me a second to think. So it started off with him and then other people also got involved,
right.
Mainly Mrs. Hendricks was a really, really big one.
Right.
And then also, okay, so I had Pastor Stalnecker until I was about end of eighth grade, ninth grade, maybe. That was a long time ago, but right around that time frame. And then he stepped down and we had another pastor come in who is from, what's that college? First Baptist in Indiana?
Yeah, Hiles Anderson. It's First Baptist Church, but Hiles Anderson is the college.
Hiles Anderson. So he came from there and like a lot of things changed in that regard. Pastor Stalnecker was very much so, you know, we need to work together. Pastor Sibowski was very divisive. And so that's kind of how the dynamics changed with Mr. Dorchis. I mean, he eventually left, but all of a sudden it was like, okay, you know, everybody needs to keep an eyeball on what everybody is doing.
Right.
And if you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing or what he thinks you're supposed to be doing, then you get in trouble.
Right.
Or you get shunned.
Right. So what was one of those first experiences or interactions?
I can't really think of any one of my first ones while I was in high school, mostly because I don't really remember a lot of high school, except for key times. But I would definitely say my senior year, I didn't want to go to a Bible college at all. Hmm. I had no desire to teach or be a secretary or, you know, any of the things that women are allowed to do. And so can we move on from that question? I have to think about it.
Yeah, that's fine. We can circle back.
Okay.
So kind of going to the post-high school experience, did you end up going to a Bible college after, you know, obviously there was some pressure there. Did you end up actually making that jump, or is it something where you left the high school and then just kind of continued on your own path?
I went to Bible college. I went to West Coast Baptist College.
I actually didn't know that. No, I actually had no idea that you went there. okay. So what was that experience like? So that would be, what time period would that be? That would be right around 2003. So what was that? Would that be right? I don't feel like.
2003.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Why? Oh yeah. 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 That is right. That's right. Okay. So I'm doing the math in my head, which takes me a while. So what was that experience like being at?
It was miserable.
Okay.
Not going to lie. It was miserable. Being in the situation that I was in with my mom being the secretary, I got to know a lot of people that a lot of people wouldn't necessarily normally get to know. So like, you know, I talked one-on-one with Dr. Getch, with Dr. Rasmussen, with the Weavers, with Fursell. I knew them because I played sports. I knew their daughters, and right. I met them that way. Right. And then also, you know, being my mom's daughter and helping, I, you know, took phone calls. I did emails. I did a bunch of stuff. So I got to know a lot of people. So going into West Coast, at first, it was like, oh my gosh, this is so great. You know, there's so much more people and, you know, this is just great. But then you have the pressure because of who I am. And I think it's even more so for pastor's kids, that like a higher pressure as far as you have to fit in this mold.
Right.
And as a girl, it's even worse fitting into the mold because, okay, number one, I have curly hair and I know that seems so silly, but I was told that I was lazy if I didn't straighten my hair every morning.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. Right?
Right. And just for context too, like West Coast at that point was barely 8 years old. So it was really, really new. What was the size of the college like at that time? I have to assume it was much smaller than it is now, and it's already pretty small.
Well, how big is it now?
Probably, that's a good question. I would guess they have around 2,000 students.
Maybe 700.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I would have guessed, is that would be in the hundreds, not thousands. Mm-hmm. Watch, I'm probably completely wrong on my number. I don't even know where I would find that, but I think that's what I heard, is like it's around 2,000 now.
Sounds about right.
So, I mean, but, and that's what seems to be when I'm there. I haven't been there in a couple of years. So it was a smaller, they were obviously even a lot stricter too. I mean,
absolutely.
They were much stricter now. And that's the weird thing about these conversations too, is that, you know, like even your experience with Sidlowski versus mine, like by the point that I was older, he was a lot, and I think it's because he got away from the Hiles world, was much looser.
I have stories
to
tell you about him.
Well, I'm sure. But like, that's the thing, is like, it's just so weird because of how things shift, like, and the amount of like, in some ways, like, that's a good thing, like that some things change and don't stay as crazy as they are. But then on the other hand too, with like colleges like West Coast, you know, the weird thing is like, nothing's ever acknowledged that was done wrong. Like, it just kind of slowly gets swept under of like, oh, well, that never happened. We've always been like, we've always let people wear jeans on Saturday. You know, it's like,
oh my gosh, exactly.
It's just kind of weird stuff. So, so you were in West Coast in its super hyper fundy infancy. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I cut you off, but you mentioned the weird standards with, even with the way that you look, you know, and you mentioned obviously the Weavers, which have been mentioned on the show before, like super, super, super. I think he's actually from Hiles as well. I'd have to double check, but he was obviously probably a big part of your life during that time. So just give me a little bit of a rundown of your college experience and what that was like.
It was basically, they run you ragged. As a girl, you couldn't go anywhere outside of campus unless you had three people. I fortunately had a super small truck that could only fit two people, so that's irrelevant. As a girl, there was only certain places that you were allowed to work. You couldn't work nights at all. I was paying my way through college and I had to work, but I wasn't really allowed to. So that kind of, you know, wasn't really that cool.
Right.
Let's see, other weird things, you know, having to wear nylons. I'm allergic to nylons, so I would break out in hives every day, but they didn't really care. As far as the whole running you ragged, people need their sleep in order to function.
Right.
And some people more so than others, but you know, I'm getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, going to bed at midnight or 11 o'clock, depending on what was going on. Because after the end of the day, you still had, and I don't even remember what it was called, but like on Mondays you had, I don't know, prayer meeting or something like that, just with the girls.
Right, within the dorms, right? There was basically like a group devotional. Yeah, because that was still going on when we would go to like tournaments and stuff. We would get we'd get to see that and be a part of that, which was, you know, supposed to be like a good, you know, first interaction. So,
you know, not getting the sleep that you needed created other health problems, you know. I would start getting migraines.
Right.
And I would call in sick to Mrs. Weaver. And she told me that I had to show up anyways because migraines were fake. So, you know, that, I mean, that's kind of the extent of it. There were fun things that happened, you know, things that I had never been a part of because our school was so small. But like different sporting events, you know, volleyball, the basketball games, which were pretty cool. There's good and there's bad within, but that's essentially my college experience. It kind of sucked.
Right. So what ended up being your kind of post-college experience? What was the direction that you took after graduating? If you did graduate, or did you end up leaving a little bit early?
Well, I technically graduated.
Okay.
I finished in 3.5 years, but you know, it doesn't count at all towards anything.
Right.
But I had actually, okay, so finishing in 3.5 years, I had gotten married.
Okay.
Gosh, how old was I? 19, 20? I was 20.
Okay.
I was 20. And so at that point, I was kind of like very, this sounds so bad, but I was very just rebellious. I didn't want to have anything to do with church. I didn't want to have anything to do. I mean, if you put a rule, quote unquote, on me, I balked it. If you told me to wear a skirt below my knees, I wore a skirt freaking above my knees. Like just, you know, just that kind of mentality.
Right.
I got married. And at that point, because I was more on my own, even though I wasn't, like that's a totally different subject. It was, I kind of sort of got back into the IFB because my whole thing at that time, my whole thinking was, if I can't get out of it, I might as well as make something into it. And at least instead of not having control, be in control. And that is so bad. Like it really is. I have so many regrets during that time frame. But that was just like my survival mode. Is like that was my survival mode.
Right.
Is to control others.
And how did that kind of manifest itself? You know, obviously that mindset going into a marriage is not the best when you're transitioning in. And can you talk about maybe how that affected that relationship and, you know, maybe other relationships that you had at the time? Because I wouldn't assume you had many other really close relationships outside of family. I don't know if it affected there as well, but can you just talk about how that mindset affected things?
Well, the mindset, okay, so part of not having any control as far as me being an individual person had to do with my marriage as well as with the IFB culture.
Okay. And was your husband part of the IFB as well?
Oh, majorly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
My ex-husband.
Right.
Just to clarify. Sorry.
Right. No, no worries.
So the way that my version as far as being in control was, so me and Brian worked with the youth group.
Okay.
And I became the person that I never wanted to be, which was super judgmental. I mean, super judgmental, super strict. If you broke the rules, I was all over you. And it affected, well, see, obviously anything, when you do anything like that, no matter in what situation that you're in, it's going to affect people. But I think right. that because people were already in that type of environment, it was like, oh, okay, she's just another person kind of a thing right. that is a part of this whole thing.
Right.
So I don't know. I really couldn't tell you how it affected me or really affected other people just because they were already in that environment.
So, well, it's crazy because I totally forgot that you guys came back and did that, which is just super weird. And I don't even know if that speaks to the movement experience at all. For me, like, I don't know. I always feel like that with stuff of like, oh, I totally forgot that period of my life happened or this, mm-hmm. this stretch of things. Yeah, I totally forgot that because I was in like, I think I was in like fifth grade at the time, maybe fourth.
How old are you?
I'm 25.
Oh my gosh, you're young.
Okay. Yeah. So we had totally, that's what I mean. We had totally like, I have enough knowledge to like be able to reference the people you're mentioning, but like mm-hmm. I never had like my experiences of Dorchess. Yeah. My experiences of like Dorchess, I was maybe.
You were a baby.
First grade, mm-hmm. you know, maybe second grade when he left, mm-hmm. You know, I remember a little bit more of him because my brother was like super close friends with his son. So like he was over a lot, but yeah, it's weird. And like, even with you guys, like I just totally, when you said that, I flash back because I remember like there was I only remember one time, but I remember there was a time in like, I want to say like maybe third or fourth grade where we, yeah, it must've been like third, must have been third grade. But I just remember we like combined with the youth group for one night or something. And mm-hmm. and so I totally forgot that there was that gap because in my mind it was Dorchess the neater. But I right, totally forgot okay. there was a whole period of like it was you guys. I totally blanked on that. So that's super weird. Anyway, I'm sorry I keep cutting off, but I'm like long. Unlocking memories during this during this conversation. You're fine. So.
He was totally fine. And it was a really short period where we were by ourselves. And then we ended up working with the Neaters.
Right. Okay.
And that was a totally different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious. And maybe even just for myself, I'm curious, what was that experience like? And what was your first impression with that change?
I was relieved at first. He kind of gave me the creeps.
Okay.
I don't have any personal experience to be able to, you know, say this happened and, oh, that makes sense.
Right.
But I did not like being around him.
Right.
At all.
Okay.
And I did not like him being around the girls.
Hmm. Okay.
So I don't really, I mean, we weren't there for too much longer after he came in because Pastor Sabosky ended up kicking me out of church.
Okay. Yeah, I have lots of questions about what you just said because I'm curious, and maybe this would even be a good post podcast conversation. But I'm assuming it's primarily like a gut feeling that something was a little weird.
Yes.
But nothing mm-hmm. nothing you could point to and be like, oh, that was it.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, we'll put a pin in that for now. Kicking out of the church, that's a pretty big life event to happen. So what surrounded that and what was the final kind of reason that you ended up getting the boot?
You want to know what started it all?
I think
breastfeeding.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't expect that. So
breastfeeding, go figure.
Okay.
So I had just had, I don't remember which kid. It was either Justin, well, I only have two children right now, but it was either Justin or Dylan.
Okay.
I want to say it was Justin. And at that point, like, my eyes were way more open. I was doing a lot of studying as far as what Pastor Sadowski was preaching versus what the Bible said. And actually, I have a friend out in Philadelphia, and she and I were going through the same thing at the same time, and we were just comparing notes together, going over different things.
Right.
Well, I was still at that point, I'm a rule follower, but not in the sense of, okay, cool, your skirt's above your knees. I don't really care about that anymore. But a rule follower as far as, you know, if the government says this, you just, you do it, you know, within reason, right. You do it. You know, same thing, speed limit, wearing your seatbelt, et cetera. So with breastfeeding, I always had a cover. Well, I did not want to go into the nursery to breastfeed because all of the women would just gossip. Not something that I was interested in.
Right.
And so I would nurse in the very, very back of the church, you know, discreetly. And he had talked to Mrs. Dollinger and had told her to tell me that if I did not breastfeed in the nursery, that I would, there would be ramifications. He didn't really say what, she didn't really say what, she just implied. Right. So I'm like, okay. So I went into the nursery and, you know, I would feed my kid. And then Mrs. Dollinger, with all of the ladies in there, ripped into me about how I need to do what pastor says, period, end of story. If you do not go behind that crib, you know, he's going to do something, or, you know, you just won't be able to feed in here anymore, and you'll, you know, et cetera. And I'm like, okay. And I kept my mouth shut, and that took a lot in me to keep my mouth shut and not to be disrespectful to her. But later that night, he called us into the office, and he kicked us out and said, you are no longer welcome here. If you can't do what I say without any questions asked, then you don't belong here.
Wow.
I was like, okay, thanks. So that was kind of the starting point of getting out of the IFB. But I still went to, how many more churches after that? I think I went to 2 more churches after that.
Okay.
Before I finally said, screw it.
Right. Right.
And I actually got kicked out of both of those churches too.
for same reasons, or was it different
things for reasons. Each ones?
Okay.
Different reasons.
Right.
And at these other 2 churches, they were both for the same reason. So I don't dress frumpy. And I got kicked out of both churches for dressing too attractive.
Win for you, I guess. I mean, take pride. I've never been kicked out anywhere for being too good looking. So I guess you can.
They told me to dress frumpy. Huh. And I'm like, what the heck?
Right. Huh. Okay. Well, that's an interesting one. So you're kicked out of the second church. What's the next route? Is it a conversation between your husband or your ex-husband saying, you know, hey, do we even want to keep doing this? Do we want to find another church? Like, what was that conversation like walking out the doors that third time now?
Well, the second time it was no big deal to me. The church was really far away. I was only going there because the Beesons were going there.
Right.
And then this other church I went to because my mom had been going there and she just really, really liked it. Because at that point she had left Mountain Avenue and I don't really know her entire story as far as why she left.
Huh,
but okay. At this other one, what had happened is, again, you know, me and Brian were in charge of the youth group. Me and my mom actually co-taught the girls. The teen girls, we had the older group, the high schoolers essentially, and then another lady had the 6th through 8th graders.
Right.
And one Sunday morning, I mean, it was super
and what
completely
church,
out of the blue.
What church was that, if you don't mind me asking? Because I had no idea the Beasts even went to another church in California. So, like,
oh,
I guess
one.
I was super out of the loop. But
And let me think of what the name was.
Yeah, no worries. It's not super relevant. I'm just curious for.
Well, it was out in the desert, in Palm Desert.
Really?
And it was with Clifford, I think.
I have no idea.
Do you know? Okay, you have no idea. All right.
Was Cliff older than me. Wasn't Clifford, was he one of the original pastors at Mount Avenue? Or no?
No.
Am I totally just way off? Okay, let's just move on from that because I'm like, I'm asking inside baseball questions that no one's going to care about but me. But anyway, so walking out of the second one.
Later.
Right. Yeah. No, I definitely. So you had left the second one. That didn't really bother you. And then the third one, did that one really hit home?
It actually did because it came completely out of the blue. I had no idea that there was anything wrong. I played the piano for them. I taught youth group, you know, for the girls. Very, very involved. Like there wasn't anything. He kind of reminded me of Pastor Spelnecker, to be honest with you. The church was really small. They were very, you know, you need to do what the Bible says, period. Don't do what I say. You need to come up with your own standards, your own convictions, what you believe, whether I believe it or not. Like that was very, very much so that. And he came from Hiles. He graduated from Hiles, grew up in Indiana, I believe. That might have been his wife. And then he moved out here. And at the time we were at a really, it was a small church. And then we moved and we took over a Southern Baptist church and they ended up merging. Right. Well, now all of a sudden he has, you know, a really big church and he was just, I don't know if going from a small church and being humble to all of a sudden I have a big church to I need to implement all these rules back again. Right. Kind of a thing. Cause that's essentially what happened. But as far as getting kicked out, it was completely out of the blue. It was on Sunday morning. I had walked into my Sunday school class with my mom and Pastor Beard's wife came in and she said, you are no, and mind you, this was in front of all of the teens. And she's like, you are no longer going to be teaching Sunday school anymore. And you're done. And I'm like, okay, like blindsided. And then I was supposed to play the piano that night and that was gone. And he had called me in, Pastor Beard had called me in later that after that, before church, but it was like early evening. And he told me what his problem was. He goes, I don't like the way that you dress. You need to start wearing frumpy clothes. My wife is not comfortable with you. And I'm like, And so we just ended up leaving. He said, either you do this or you're not welcome here anymore.
Right. Huh. So, after that, was it just something where you were kind of internally like, I'm done with this? Or was it something where it was, you know, was it something where you're like, man, is there, what was that next step?
The next step for me was I'm done with it. I'm no longer going to church. I'm over it. Brian still went to an ISB church. I don't even know which one he went to, but he went to one and I was done.
And did he just feel like that's what was supposed to be done? Like there's nothing. I mean, cause I know for a lot of people, no matter how many times that kind of situation happens, it's so ingrained in them that that's something that they need to be a part of. They'll constantly go seek out the exact same type of church, even though they know it's going to lead to like negative connotations. So was that kind of the mindset was just, I can't not go. Was that kind of what prompted that?
For Brian?
Yeah.
Brian is already very controlling. So being in the IFB, he thrived in it because he got to be controlling. So I can't really say that it is something that he grew up in per se, because he didn't. But being the person that he is, where else would he go?
How long did that last as far as like going, I mean, essentially two separate, I mean, very opposite directions, going to church, not going to church. Was that something that just put a massive strain over the next several months, years, weeks? Like what was kind of the timeline after that?
As far as getting kicked out of the church, the last one that I was in, I probably would have gone to another IFB church thinking that, you know, maybe this was just a weird anomaly.
Right.
And I probably would have given another church another try. And I probably would have given several churches another try, to be honest with you. But what was really, really eye-opening was when my daughter passed away. And like maybe 3 months after she had passed away, everybody at that, not everybody, but a lot of people at that church were like, okay, it's time for you to get over it. You don't need to be sad anymore. It's time for you to get back and, you know, get going.
Right.
And that was just kind of like, huh. And so because of that happening, I think God really opened up my eyes a lot to, you know, you're running into the same problem, no matter what city it is in. This is not who I am. This is not how I want people to portray me to be as. So after that had happened, it really wasn't much longer before I left my ex.
Right. Wow.
Because he was still in that whole mindset of, I am in control. You do what I say. You are not capable of anything except for to be my wife and to have my children. So. Wow.
Yeah. Well, that's so weird that you said. So like, this is another instance where like something you said just totally triggers a memory. But a few years ago, I don't know if you know, cause I don't remember if we were Facebook friends or anything during that period, but in 2015, my wife and I got married, and then we ended up having a miscarriage like right. I mean, it was like 3 or maybe 4 months in. And which was, so that was a very jarring, painful experience. And it happened in really scary circumstances. We were outside the country, actually. We were in India when it happened. And so it was a very scary time, and it was a lot of mental, it's one of the most devastating things that can happen to you. It had a huge effect in early on in a marriage, and you're still trying to figure that out. And I remember after that happened, I want to be super careful how I say all this, because I don't at all want to take the subject lightly, but I just remember there was someone in the church who you and I both know who experienced that stuff. Even right after that, they were still in church the next day. The expectation that was kind of subliminally in the church, I guess that's kind of what I'm hitting at, was the idea of like, oh, it's such a mark of a true Christian to be able to push through that event, versus like, it's basically, if you think of the opposite, you're saying, well, if we couldn't do that, we're not as good a Christian. And that's kind of where I'm really hitting. I don't think it's so much with the people, because I really do. Like, it's one of those things where, like, I remember that thinking years later when it happened to us, like, man, that expectation was so backwards. And that expectation was so harmful for people who were experiencing stuff like that. And I remember right after everything happened, and it's just interesting that you said that, because I remember right after that happened, that same person just commented that he felt that it was a lot of overblown kind of emotions and things like that. And I remember I was questioning whether or not to bring that up, because it's a super, super sensitive topic, but I just remember not thinking anything of it at the time, which like scares me that I didn't think anything of something like that at the time. But I remember thinking exactly of that moment when that happened to us and thinking, man, if that mindset of like, oh, you can't deal with the trauma of, you know, that experience, like that's a really toxic environment. And so I can confirm what you just said based on that experience of like, I know there was at least one person who was already in that mode of like, well, time to move on and keep being faithful. And yeah, that's, it's just really weird, because it's one of those things where, like, that's why I don't question anybody when, like, mm-hmm. to be honest with you, like when you reached out, and I know I mentioned this before, but like when you reached out, there was a big part of me that was like just scared to do it, because I was like, well, I know this person. And it does, it goes through your mind where it's like, are they going to mention someone that I know? Are they going to mention someone that I like? Are they going to talk about it? But that's the problem when we start trying to validate whose story is true because of our experience.
Exactly. Well,
the truth is, like, our experience, we could have not known the sight of someone that someone's talking about. We could have blocked out, like for me, I blocked out that memory. Like, even after that happened to us and I thought about it, I blocked it out and it didn't reappear in my mind until you just said that. And then I'm thinking, oh, she's right. That definitely was the attitude that was towards you guys. And that's super, super, super toxic. Like, but the truth is, when you're bought into something like this, you don't think of it as toxic. You just think of it as your way of life. And so I 100%, 100% can confirm that that was the case and that was true. And that's like, it terrifies me that as someone who, I want to say I was older. I was like junior high. I was like maybe middle school. But the fact that that didn't register as like so bizarre terrifies me. And I have a lot of things like that where like thought processes, mindsets, and things that I heard that were so normalized. And that's, you know, I don't even know where to go with that. But it just really is like, that is such a major red flag. And I was still in the movement for, you know, obviously not necessarily by choice, but I was still in that movement bought in for the next several years, like almost a decade after that, you know, that's, that's really scary. So, this is just so weird. It's really weird to hear names and then start thinking like, man, that all fits. And like, even beyond that, like, I understand where that happened, you know, like I see that happening. I saw that happening, but it was so normal. I didn't think about it at the time. That's a lot. So after that experience, is there much more after that, or was it pretty much just as it went on, it just kind of fractured just because of the stress of, you know, two different worldviews kind of trying to make sense of life at that point. After having, you know, the third church and then obviously having many different voices telling you how to process with your own emotions and your own life, is that pretty much what just slowly, it just, things disintegrated and you just kind of went your own way? Or is there any more IFB type experience post that?
Well, I'm assuming you're talking about Brian. Are you talking about the church?
Okay. Yeah, because I know you mentioned before like some of the marriage side. So I'm just curious if that was a pretty quick dissolve or if that was something that, you know, was there any more, you know, because of the church situation that kept spiking up, or just what was the trajectory after that? Because that's the end of my interaction, really, was that event. Unless I'm totally blanking, like, I can't remember really seeing you guys at all after that. On and off throughout, but not frequently.
Yeah, you got that right. I think maybe the most interaction we would have had was when Justin went to kindergarten with Lucy Raymond's class.
Yeah, like, oh, hey, I haven't seen you in a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of stuff, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, and you were so much younger than me, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's, yeah.
You didn't have the same circle or anything like that. But anyways, to answer your question, as far as Brian and I, we didn't really dissolve our marriage because necessarily of the IFB, as far as, you know, getting kicked out of churches, etc. Our marriage dissolved because he was very abusive psychologically. And he thrived in the IFB culture because what do they promote, honestly, as far as, you know, a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, etc.
Right.
And So like I said, as far as after Emma passing away, like God just really opened up my eyes to, because I always thought that I was the mistake, that I was wrong, et cetera. But I didn't really know how to stand up for myself either, because right. I was always taught, you know, the man is right. The man is the head of the household. You do what the man says, period, regardless of whether you're married or not. And just to give you an example, you know, if I were to make a comment like, oh my gosh, the sky is so pretty, it's so blue today, he would come at me in like a million different directions, trying to convince me that the sky was purple. And it was exhausting. And it would happen for anything and everything. It didn't matter. It wasn't an argument per se. It was just very psychological, you know? I would bring up legitimate, you know, issues as far as things that I saw in the church. And all of a sudden it would turn around to where I'm the one that's causing everything. And I am, and the reason why we keep getting kicked out is because I am the sole problem. And so it dissolved because of that. My kids started emulating Brian, and it was at that point to where I'm like, nope, I'm done. And, you know, he stalked me for like a month before I was able to leave. And I finally, I was finally able to leave. And it took a lot to be able to do that. Like a lot.
Right.
I had zero friends, wasn't allowed to get a job, had no money. I mean, nothing. I didn't even know if I was going to be able to stay at my mom's house because she had just gotten married.
Right.
But I did it.
Was your mom at that point completely out of that movement, or was she still attending an IFB church at that time? Like, were you able to communicate with her about that stuff? Or did you feel like you didn't really have that connection even at that point?
I was not able to talk to my mom about that at all. She's, and this doesn't have anything to do with the IFB as far as her mentality goes. She just loves being at home, and she loves doing anything for her husband, period.
Right.
Like, she loves that, and that has nothing to do with anything. And
yeah,
so
that's not necessarily a negative trait.
Right.
It's just she wouldn't necessarily understand the frustrations that you were having with your
exactly.
personality. That's also not wrong. So, right.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so I was able to talk to her, my stepdad, and, you know, just he saw everything. Okay, so he saw everything. He's met Brian before, and he knew exactly where I was coming from. And he just basically put his foot down and said, she can stay here. And it was a good thing that I went there, because Brian ended up coming after me that night and was very, very aggressive. And if my stepdad wasn't there, honestly, I don't know that I would be alive.
So it was physically very aggressive?
That night he was.
Okay.
And he has been with me in the past, but it was mostly psychological.
Right.
And then, you know, later on, as I was still trying to divorce him, because I've had to call the police officers on him, and I was told by the detective, don't ever be alone with him, because right now he is controlling, he is being manipulative by pretending to be suicidal, but he'll kill you and then he'll kill himself. I was
right.
like, okay.
Right.
So it wasn't a good situation, but I'm out of it.
Right. Right. So what's been your process since having left? Like, what's been the experience? Obviously you're in a much better place now, it seems. Can you talk a little bit about that journey, and maybe just say like what's been most helpful to you as you've kind of moved forward and kind of really claimed your life? I mean, just taken control and gotten to really experience like life the way that you were wanting to experience it.
Well, there's four things.
Okay.
Number one, CrossFit. Go figure.
Okay.
Well, and I'll tell you why CrossFit. So CrossFit is very grueling, but it strengthens you up mentally, because if you can't, you really have to like be able to get through something in your brain in order to get through it with your body. Okay. I'm not saying like screw yourself over and like go 100% all the time, kind of a thing, but that helped a lot. And as a result of being at that particular CrossFit gym, I made a lot of friends there that I still talk to this day. The other thing was not going to church and just letting it all go and basically starting off with a blank slate and really rewiring my brain as far as what is true and what is not. I'm still very much so a Christian, just not like I was. And I'm very much so aware of, you know, that's not who God is at all.
Right.
You know, back then, you know, God is angry. He is, you know, if you do this wrong, you're going to get in trouble, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, that's not who he is.
Right.
The other thing was talking to two friends, and we were going through the same, I mean, both of us were both leaving our abusive husbands at the same time and leaving the IFB at the same time. Right. And being able to realize that, hey, I'm not crazy. My, you know, and having that community of friends, mind you, we don't live anywhere near each other at all. Like at all. Our only connection is going to West Coast. Hmm. So being able to talk to them was huge.
Right.
Because like I said, you realize that you're not crazy and it's not all in your head.
Right.
But those are really the main things as far as helping me to not only just get out of it, but get out of it mentally and realize that, hey, you know what? You're okay.
The friendship side is so important. And like, that's one thing that's consistently hit on the show with different interviews is people saying like, oh, it was a community of people. And it's really sad that a lot of people have to leave the church to fight a community of people that care about them when that's what the church like advertises itself to be. And again, like I know people are going to be mad and leave comments. So I'll just say, even though I shouldn't have to say it, not every church is like that, but it really is. Like it's the churches where this stuff happens and it goes unnoticed. Like it really is like it, the fact that people recover by just getting into a community of people who aren't jerks tells you like how messed up their church situation was. Because if there was a church of people who genuinely cared, a lot of this stuff would be avoided. If there wasn't the politics and the power moves and the fight for attention or to be the most holy of them all, you know, it really would change so many of these stories at their root. There wouldn't be the conversation of, you know, someone was controlling, someone was jealous because their husband couldn't keep their eyes off of this person in the church when they're standing behind the pulpit. Like those conversations wouldn't be happening. And, yeah. And then also like the CrossFit side, like it hasn't released yet as of this recording, but I just interviewed Jesse Beyer, who has written a lot on, she's wrote a book on trauma and how we process it. And one of the big things that she mentioned, and I shouldn't have been shocked that you said CrossFit, but one of the things she mentioned was, you know, sometimes therapy isn't sitting down in a room with someone and talking, because that's sometimes the least helpful thing. A lot of times trauma, and it's, I mean, this is just a known fact in the medical world, is like a lot of times trauma is stored in your body. And so
it is.
A lot of times that correlation of working on your body or creating these physical goals can help you drastically on the mental side. So that all makes a lot of sense. And I like, right when I was like, really? And then I was like, why am I surprised? Because I just had a conversation yesterday talking through that. So yeah. So no, I think that's really good. So we talked a little bit about like, you know, having a healthy community versus a toxic community. And like one of the things that obviously I felt turned very toxic toward you and your family, even when I was still attending the church, was a lot of the church members' attitude toward your family, because your brother is gay, and that topic and that subject, was something that was constantly talked about. I know that from firsthand. Like, I was old enough where I was very early on in my youth group experience, but it wasn't uncommon. And I've talked about this on the show before. It wasn't uncommon to hear, you know, people that worked with the youth group saying, you know, calling people a fag, or, you know, making fun of them the minute they walked into the church. And it was very dehumanizing language used about anyone who pursued that lifestyle. And It wasn't the same way that people who, because look, this show's not about religious beliefs, like, and even in conversations one-on-one with people, I don't think that's the crux of the issue. I don't think it's whether or not, well, do you think the Bible actually says this? Like,
right.
That conversation, it has its place. But, like, regardless of that, you know, there are very clear, you know, ways that people should be treated, and people who are human beings deserve respect as human beings. So it's one of those things where, like, I've had so many conversations with people who are Christians, and essentially the conversation always will end up being, you know, hey, I think so-and-so is gay, or it's just always kind of this whispered, like, hey, I think this might be going on. And I'm always sitting there like, okay, what happens if they are? Are they dead to you? Do you not talk to them? Is there no respect there? Is nothing they believe valid? Because I don't see you biting your nails over someone who's living with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, which is also biblical guideline for relationships. So it just seems like people really hone in on that because it's something that they don't identify with at all. A guy can sit, a pastor can get the idea of, like, oh, well, I'm attracted to women, so I could see slipping up there or doing this. They can't put themselves in the shoes of something that they don't personally have a mindset related to. So can you talk a little bit about how that experience affected you? Because I can't imagine that happened in a vacuum. Like, that had to have ramifications on your IFB experience as well.
I can. So when – this is going to be kind of a little – it's going to be everywhere.
It's fine. And you know what? So, before you say that, I actually want to say this too, because I want to be complete. I try to be very transparent on this show and honest. When I was in my later years of high school, like just getting ready to get out, that stuff really bothered me, that kind of language and talking about people. But I do want to just be honest and say there was a long period, like literally up till I was probably, and it still carried over. Like I'm still unlearning or learning how to treat people better. Like that's an ongoing journey. But I was saying the same kind of slurs. I was having conversations laughing. Like I was very much, again, bought into that mindset. Mm-hmm. And when your youth pastor is doing it, it's okay. And so I just want to be very clear for anyone listening. I don't want to sit here and on a high horse and say I never did that stuff. Like I want to be very clear and say, yeah, it was super wrong. I see it as wrong, and I feel like more people need to see it as wrong. So I just want to say that before moving forward, because I think it's important to admit, you know, even if you are a part of something where you're being taught something wrong, you need to own when you do something wrong. So, but anyway, moving forward with your story here.
So as far as that goes, I actually didn't know that Phil was calling my brother that at all. I didn't know it was that bad because I was kind of going through my own thing with Brian and with my daughter dying, et cetera. But as far as like when my brother came out to me, it didn't really change me and my brother per se at all, or even it did with my mom, but definitely not with me and my brother because we were already close as it is. And I have a lot of theories, but When he came out to me, I just basically told him, you know, I don't agree with it. I go, but I'm not going to love you any differently, and I'm not going to treat you any differently. And after hearing, you know, what you had said, it makes total sense as far as why he was so relieved. You know, he was crying because he thought I was going to shun him and keep him away from the boys and never see him again. And so I think because hearing his experience as far as that goes, I just, you know, like you said, I don't get why people would want to treat anybody else different just because they're different.
When someone's not physically hurting you, when there's no, you know what I mean? Like, you mm-hmm. have to, like, it's just weird to have that amount of vitriol over something. Like, if you think it's a sin issue, you know, like, you think about all the other things that you don't act like that for. Like I said, like, you don't act mm-hmm. like that when someone's living with their girlfriend, which
exactly.
is just as frowned upon, if not talked about more, you know, mm-hmm. like, that's a very serious thing as well. So yeah, I think that that makes a lot of sense as far as like why, you know, why you were able to deal with it the way you did and why he felt the way that he did. And just to be clear too, like, I don't know if you just knew that from me saying that on the show, that kind of stuff was being said, but I have no idea if that was said directly to him. Cause like from my perspective, yeah. Cause from what I saw personally, it was like just general niceties when he was there. And it was like, as he was walking up or as he was leaving, it was like shifted to like, oh goodness. Like there's, you know what I mean? Like that kind of back, you know, everything in that movement is generally behind the back. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, unless it's from the pulpit, but you know, it's a lot of times it's just gossip behind the back. Like, and I was so close with a lot of those people that mm-hmm. I would hear that stuff casually because I was part of it. And mm-hmm. that kind of makes me sick to say now, is like, they knew, I guess I could take it or I could handle that conversation. But anyway, I don't want to keep taking the mic from you.
No, you're fine. Like, the more you keep talking about stuff, like, things keep resurfacing as far as things that had happened. So I remember, okay, so you know Phil has a sister?
Yes.
Alyssa?
Yeah.
So my brother actually dated her for a while.
I think I remember that actually a little bit.
Went out to Michigan. I mean,
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. And get this, he went out to Michigan to see her. My mom wasn't able to take my brother up there, and he wasn't quite old enough, if I remember correctly, to fly by himself. So Phil and Ingrid said that they would take my brother out there if he paid for their whole trip. So he paid for their whole trip to go out there. And I don't know if something happened or whatnot, but when he came back, he was a different person. Something else that I also vaguely remember. So Mr. Dorchess had accused my brother of raping his son. And
really?
Yeah. Yeah. He's completely like disowned us, him, his daughter, like all of them. But my brother is like, what on earth are you talking about? And it just kind of makes me wonder, as far as my theory, in addition to research, is that not everybody, okay, not everybody, but like there are several people who are gay who were raped or molested when they were younger.
Right.
You know, my friend was the same way. You know, she was raped while she was at West Coast. Mm-hmm. She was raped while she was at her church out in Pennsylvania. She was molested as a kid, and she wanted to have nothing to do with guys at all. And I feel like, you know, my brother is very closed off as far as that time in his life, but I feel like something happened, because why would somebody accuse him of raping them, you know?
Yeah, right.
So I can't say it affected me and my brother's relationship, but it's definitely affected, you know, everybody else around us. Like, they don't talk to us.
Right. Which in turn affects you personally. And, you know, it mm-hmm. changes. It just changes all your dynamics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just crazy. It's crazy that it's so difficult to even talk. You know what I mean? Like, it's mm-hmm. because you have to be. It's just really, to me, it's just sad. Like, I think that's the word I keep circling. It's like, it's just really sad that people can't just like, oh, hey, I love you. And yes, not exactly. have to say, I love you, even though you're this, or I love uh-huh. you, even though I think this, or I feel I love mm-hmm. you, even though, you know what I mean? Like, it's, mm-hmm. you know, I see people do that with religious stuff. Like, man, or politics. For a Democrat, they're really nice. Or for for a Muslim, yes, they're actually a really nice person. And it's like, well, a lot of Muslims are nice people. They're mm-hmm. just people, just like you and me. Like, a lot of Christians are nice people. A lot of Christians mm-hmm. are not nice people, you know? And there's always these disclaimers we put as human beings. And I think it's really unfortunate. And I think when you have a culture where, especially when you're quote unquote separatist in your belief system, like, there's a lot of times you can lean into that really heavily and just label everybody who's not like you and then mm-hmm. have degrees of separation with them. And I think that's super, super harmful mm-hmm. when you're, especially when you're a church. So yeah, I just wanted to hit on that because I think that's something like I can personally remember. And I thought that was that kind of drives home that point of like toxic culture versus mm-hmm. loving culture and healthy versus unhealthy. And I mean, your story speaks for yourself. Once you got into a healthy culture, like, things started changing. And so I think there's a lot of really important takeaways there, but yeah, I have one question that I ask everybody who comes on the show, and it's, do you think there's hope for reform of the IFB movement, or do you think it's something that just in its foundation and in its, you know, based on the kind of ruling of the IFB founding fathers, I guess you will, you know, do you think that it's kind of damaged from inception and just needs to die? Like, what's kind of your takeaway there?
Well, I would like to say that there's hope for change because I do believe that people can change.
Right.
But because of how the IFB was born, I don't think it will change.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of where I'm at. The level of that has shifted on and off, like, just depending on who I talk to and like situations, but you know, I generally agree. Like, I think that's kind of where I'm at, and I'm open, you know, doing this show, like, I'm always open to changing my mind, but like, the conversations right. I'm having both on the show and off make me feel like it's more and more connected than, like, I already knew it was really a lot of connected problems, but mm-hmm. I'm seeing it more and more. So I'm always curious what people's answer are. Because I have people that I really respect that are pushing. Like, I have a pastor I know that I really, really respect who mm-hmm. is actively trying to change it. I actually know several pastors like that, and I wish them well, but I think that right. when people talk about reforming it, you have to have something good to reform it back to. And that's mm-hmm. where I think the missing key is. I think you have to either people are either rebranding it into something that looks, you know, it's fundamentally the same, but it looks a little bit nicer, or you have to basically just tear it down to the foundation and, you know, tear down the foundation and rebuild it and, mm-hmm. you know, go from there. So, well, I really appreciate you sharing. And I mean, this is a longer episode, which just comes from like us having some similar history. There's going to be some more common conversation, but I really appreciate you talking about, we talked about a lot of difficult stuff, and I appreciate you being super transparent and, you know, just talking about it with me. I think it's going to be really helpful to people who have been in similar situations. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.